You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Latinos are the fastest growing racial or ethnic group in the country, with a total population estimated to be over 68 million people, a number that has nearly doubled over the past 25 years. They also make up about 40% of California's population, and more than half are 24 or younger. That weight comes with an increasing amount of political power. Latinos are the second largest voting bloc in the country, and their votes have been critical in determining the outcome of elections across the country, including the 2024 presidential election. This political empowerment has roots stretching back decades to Los Angeles in the 1940s and is chronicled in an upcoming book called Forging Latino Power: The Politics of Inclusion, Backlash, and Resistance. The book releases tomorrow and traces the fight of political influence among California Latinos and the impacts from the neighborhoods to the national stage. Joining us now is one of the co-authors, David Ayon. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Vicky. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, what a moment. Thank you for having Insight to be part of your moment ahead of your book release tomorrow. I'd love to start learning a little bit about yourself and your background.
I'm not a native Californian, but I've been here a long time. I first came for graduate school at Stanford decades ago. I was born and raised right on the border, El Paso, Texas, which is right the midpoint of the border between L.A. and Brownsville, Texas. And I actually did not intend to study politics when I went to college, but I was converted. I was politicized. My freshman year, wound up majoring in politics and specializing in minority politics, and I carried that through. Even though I did a lot of work on Latin America and Mexico, I was increasingly pulled into analyzing and publishing, researching and publishing about Latino politics or Latino political empowerment.
Yeah, I actually lived and worked along the border in the Rio Grande Valley. You mentioned Brownsville, so I lived in McAllen, which is about a 12-hour drive from El Paso, Texas. What have you learned over your time studying Latino politics, the evolution of Latinos in the political sphere over the last, 50, 60 years?
Well, I would say one of the things that opens the opportunity and the need for books like those I've been working on for the last 15 years, first Power Shift and then Forging Latino Power, is that, in fact, the numbers do not automatically translate into political participation or empowerment. People actually have to do it. It has to be, well, of course, you have to register people to vote, you have to get them to vote, but you also have to have candidates. In effect, and this is a term that I think a lot of people think has a negative connotation, but it's one that we use in the new book, that if you're going to really empower a community this big on this scale, you need a professional political class that is not just candidates, but people who can staff them, people who can advise them, people who can raise the money. All of those things go together. And they're not automatically produced by simply population growth. And one of the things that the book really emphasizes, I don't think it had crystallized in my mind completely, nor among my colleagues who are also Latino or Latino-focused political scientists, is that there had to be several key reforms, national reforms, really to lay the basis for Latino political empowerment across the country.
What reforms are those?
One was, and this was an issue in particular for the first Latino elected to in the 20th century to significant office, Edward Roybal. He was first elected in 1949 to the L.A. City Council, and then he went on to Congress, where he served for 30 years. But he had been pounding on this issue that if electoral districts are not drawn in a certain way, that a community that might exist but is split up by electoral district will never be able to elect a candidate of their own choosing.
Gerrymandering.
You can say it's gerrymandering, and it is, but it was done more intuitively, at least until we had a complete count of the Hispanic/Latino population. And that did not happen. It wasn't even attempted until the 1980 census. But that was an extended battle. Roybal, I think, was the most significant one who was pushing for that. that we needed to have a complete count. That means including the Hispanic origin question. It had to be added to the universal instrument that everybody gets that only had 7 questions on it. It was a very big deal to add another question to that. And that was achieved in 1980. That is the first census. It was 1980 census. And then there was a reform of the Voting Rights Act when it had to be renewed. It was never established permanently. It always had like a sunset. It had to be renewed. And in 1982, it was significantly reformed. Now, a lot of these reforms are being undone right now, as a lot of people know. But in order to actually be able to help Latinos across the country or anywhere they may be, because the original Voting Rights Act was really aimed at trying to empower African-Americans in the South. That means that the way that act was written really did not serve the purposes of Latinos, say, in California, until that 1982 extension of the VRA, Voting Rights Act. The third big reform just came 4 years later. It was passed, and that was the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986 that started in fact, on Cinco de Mayo, 1987, the window opened for purposes of people to adjust their status, to become legalized who were undocumented. There were two major parts to this. Those who had lived continuously in the country since 82, and we're talking about starting this in 87, but there was also a separate provision, this also quite entirely attributable to Latino or Latina political leadership in California. That separate provision legalized the entire undocumented farm labor force. It was a lot easier to do that than to prove that you had lived continuously in the country since 1982. Those three things laid the basis for drawing districts that where people could get elected from this community, as well as knocking down other sorts of, shall we say, barriers in electoral processes, like at-large municipal city councils, as opposed to being district at all. So those three reforms, I would say, together really laid the basis. But it still was up to flesh and blood people to implement these things, to register to voters, to organize campaigns, to get people to vote. And in California, that really took off by the mid-1990s.
I mean, you're talking about these three big moments that happened in a relatively short amount of time within the span of, you know, a decade, give or take. And then that obviously cues to the 90s. And when you start really seeing the impact of these big fundamental changes to politics in the United States, that's not that long ago. That's like 40 years ago. Yeah. I mean, how much of a game changer has it been in just a short amount of time?
It's been enormous, and you can see it comparatively, like, say, just comparing states. It used to be, for one, like, and the state we probably get compared to most is Texas, sometimes Florida, right? And those are the antitheses of what California politics is. But since Texas, say, for example, has 254 counties and lots, and as you say, your roots are in the lower Rio Grande Valley.
Right. Well, I'm an Angeleno, but I worked in McAllen, Texas for a couple of years as a journalist.
Yeah. So you know that practically most of the border area is very heavily Mexican-American, if not predominantly Mexican-American. So you had people elected. And in fact, in Texas and New Mexico just being very small, often doesn't get included. But you had a lot more Mexican-Americans holding elected office at lower levels in Texas because of its size, because of so many counties, because you had this historic area that was dominated by the Mexican origin population. So Texas led Latino office holding, Latino political empowerment, all the way up until the mid-1990s. And it was actually one of the things that set California apart was that California underwent this major political trauma, you might even say, certainly for the Latino community, of Proposition 187 in 1994, which then Governor Pete Wilson really hitched his reelection. He was practically dead in the polls before he hitched his reelection to that proposition, which would deny all but emergency medical services from people who could not show that they had legal immigration status. And the only exception to not providing emergency medical services was only in compliance with federal law, right? So California really, that is, who was in power in California up through 1994 or 96, really went after the undocumented population. And this is where this notion that there are these phases, practically a cycle of Latino political empowerment. The most elementary one is simply a politics of inclusion, trying to get people elected, trying to win representation. But sometimes what you get, sometimes in direct reaction to progress in inclusion, you get a backlash. We're living through a national backlash now. And it's not just an anti-Latino backlash. We know that a lot of different social reforms that have been advanced since the 1960s are either being dismantled or under great, great peril right now. So what do you do in a period of backlash when you really cannot, in a normal fashion, continue to advance inclusion? You shift to a politics of resistance. And this is one of the reasons why California is famous for leading the resistance to both Trump presidencies so far. If resistance succeeds, it can itself advance inclusion. And we've seen that happen. I think the 1994-96 cycle was evidence of that. Coming out of the great setback of 94, Prop 187 passes. Pete Wilson is reelected, both by landslides, and the Democratic majority in the California Assembly was lost. Came roaring back in 96, and we got the first Latino speaker of the California Assembly ever in California history. So effective resistance can include progress or can lead to progress or produce progress. And then you wind up entering, and we've been in it since then practically, a period of sustained progress of Latino empowerment in California.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with David Ayllon, co-author of the new book, Forging Latino Power. A great deal of your research over the past 15 years also includes both presidencies of President Donald Trump and the most recent one in 2024. There was a rightward shift amongst Latino communities nationally and in California. Of course, Latinos are far from a monolith when you think of them politically. How have you come to understand that shift in this larger conversation that you're having about Latino power in California and in the country?
And it was hardly unique to Latinos. And I don't know if you ever saw, I think it was the New York Times that created this map that divided the entire country up by county, and they would put a red arrow pointing towards the right and a blue arrow pointing towards the left to show how the vote had changed for president between 2020 and 2024. And practically, very nearly every single county in the country shifted to the right. That is, more votes than before, proportionately, for the Republican ticket, which in that case was Donald Trump and our Vice President J.D. Vance. That there were a few exceptions of that. There were some places, there were some parts of California that did not shift. I have come to the conclusion that what produced both the first and second Trump presidencies is really something that's sort of across the board. And that is not just, it's usually measured in polls as trust or distrust of government and other institutions. I would say, if we're going to be really frank about this, we're talking about people who practically hate politics and politicians, or have, this is a great rise, what I would call it in less loaded terms, but quite frankly, a great rise in political cynicism. And I think that cynicism is still deepening now, because, in fact, it could even start to apply. We're seeing it start to apply to Trump himself. People are growing more cynical that he's not delivering, that the economy is not significantly improving over what it was under the previous administration, the Biden-Harris administration. So I think that is a very serious problem. One of the ways in which Trump has exploited it and has continued to maintain it as much as he has, certainly amongst Republicans, is by always playing the role of the outsider. He's not a politician, or he's not a regular politician. So even things that he says that would have been considered deadly for anybody holding office in the past, insulting things, things that many people would consider racist or misogynist, the way he attacks women journalists that ever even dare ask him a question, that he responds the way he does with such animus, such, frankly, bigotry, in some case, racism, it confirms for his base he's not a regular politician. No professional politician would do that. And to the extent to which that level of cynicism, which has risen dramatically, partly fomented by Trump and his movement and expanded upon and intensified, to the extent to that can win an election, I think a professional politician really doesn't have a chance against it.
How do you think the pandemic and particularly the government's role in the pandemic shaped politics among Latinos?
Amongst Latinos, it certainly did. And across the board, it certainly did. But it wasn't all in a single direction, because I think most analysts agree that if not for COVID, Donald Trump probably would have been reelected in 2020. He also handled it as a non-politician. Latinos really suffered, particularly during COVID, for several reasons. One, because of the conditions in which they live in many cases, their conditions of work and their conditions of crowded into smaller units than the average population, but also the form of work that they did and where they worked. So many were considered essential workers, or even if they were not essential workers, in many cases, they had to continue going to work. They did not have the option, because of the kind of work that they do, they did not have the option of working from home and going on, you know, on the internet or using Zoom. So that's why we saw a tremendous rate of infection, disease, and death among the Latino community, and probably nowhere more than in Los Angeles.
Finally, you write in the description for the book that the struggle for Latino political empowerment has much to teach us. So it's publishing, it's releasing tomorrow. What do you want readers to take away from Forging Latino Power?
What I'm going to stress, and we have a big launch event at LA City Hall on Thursday, is what you can get out of this book, or at least the highest aspiration of what you can get out of this book, is to go through this narrative account of a Latino political experience, mainly in California, but not solely in California, is to see those instances in which Latina and Latino leaders faced adverse circumstances, and in some cases, one would say impossible odds, but were able to creatively work their way out of it. And that way they were able to, for example, in the 1960s, even though things changed after the 60s, organizing farm workers when that had never succeeded in many attempts in the 20th century in California. It took a new way of trying to organize farm worker communities, and that was led, and that's why Dolores Huerta plays such a big role in the book, in the first part of the book, the first three chapters. But we have many other instances in which Latina and Latino leaders and organizations have been able to figure a way out of, shall we say, a backlash or other adverse circumstances. And I would hope, my greatest hope, is that readers would hone in, try to identify those moments and think, what would I have done under those circumstances? And if you exercise that creative thinking muscle, that aids your ability to react to completely unanticipated circumstances when they come along. And we're certainly in one of those right now nationally.
David, it was a pleasure. Thank you for stopping by.
Thanks so much for having me, Vicky.
David Ayón is a co-author of Forging Latino Power, The Politics of Inclusion, Backlash, and Resistance. The book will be released tomorrow and traces the fight for political empowerment and influence among California's Latino communities. Still ahead, how far would you go to find a tree? We'll meet a UC Davis scientist willing to scale peaks all for a glimpse of the Jeffrey Pine, and we'll learn what it tells us about climate change. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.